This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
This is a pretty nakedly political bid to insert themselves in the military's decisions.
The U.S. military is far and away the largest consumer of fossil fuels in this country. Reducing the military's carbon footprint is not only important for the environment, it also would make for a much more effective, efficient military. But efforts to make the military greener are being stymied by Republicans and a few conservative Democrats in Congress. This week on Sea Change Radio, I speak with David Roberts, a staff writer at Grist.org and one of the leading environmental journalists in the country, about the current political struggle to enable the U.S. military to use alternative fuels and take other steps to reduce its carbon consumption. Roberts, who's written a series of pieces on the subject, takes us inside the Marine Corps' Expeditionary Energy Office and tries to wade through the political morass that's keeping these forward-thinking efforts from becoming standard operating procedure.
Problem is all inside your head, she said to me. The answer is easy if you take it logically. I'd like to help you in your struggle to be free. There must be 50 ways to leave your lover.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by David Roberts. He's a staff writer at Grist.org. David, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex.
So give us a little background on the infighting that's going on to try to allow the military to use alternative fuels.
Well, the military, even before the Obama era, starting in the late Bush era, has started to get serious about trying to use fewer fossil fuels, mainly less oil. And that really took on a lot of momentum under Obama. His Secretary of the Navy, Ray Mabus, in particular, has really gone gung-ho on this effort. And thus far, it's more, up until recently, it's more or less gone on unremarked in the larger political world. But now it's, now we're coming up towards this so-called fiscal cliff, and there are serious cuts to the military budget proposed. And so now, you know, Republicans are trying to make hay out of this. They're trying to get a political attack out of this. And one of the angles they're now taking is this idea that how can you cut the military when you're spending money on this frivolous stuff, this frivolous green energy, when you're wasting money on more expensive boutique energy sources? That's a waste of money, especially in the context of military cutbacks. And so now two committees, the House and Senate Armed Services Committees, have, in the course of coming up with a new Pentagon budget for next year, have put in amendments saying that the military can no longer purchase fuels that are more expensive than traditional fossil fuels. And now it sort of sounds, you know, it's phrased to sound commonsensical. Why would you want the military to spend more money on something when it could spend less money on something, right? I mean, it sounds like it's fiscal conservatism. But in fact, that would sort of at a stroke prevent the military from testing new fuels. I mean, one of the things the military has done is really ramped up this field testing system where they're helping not only in the sort of R&D end, the manufacture and design and research into new fuels, but also they're telling businesses and you know, clean energy businesses, if you can ramp up, if you can start producing this stuff at a reasonable cost, we will be a huge consumer for you. So it's a guarantee in a sense for businesses to take risks and make investments in trying to stand up these industries, these clean fuel industries.
And a guarantee that the prices would come down in those selected industries too, I imagine.
Well, yes. The idea is that the military is a large enough customer of fuel. It spent, I think in 2009, it spent over $13 billion on energy. It's the biggest energy consumer in the U.S. So if the military is if you're guaranteed to have the military as a customer, you can scale up. And when you scale up, prices come down. It's how any new product works in any industry. But if you can't test those products, if you can't be a part of that cycle doing large-scale field testing, if you can't ever purchase anything that's more expensive than fossil fuels, then you can't test any alternatives to fossil fuels. So these amendments amount to saying continue using exclusively fossil fuels until a cheaper alternative fuel falls out of the sky. It sort of takes the military out of the game of being involved in, you know, helping those alternatives develop.
And just explain a little bit of the political machinations behind it. There's a couple bills, right? There's the Senate Arms Committee that has a recommendation, or is this law that they're trying to push for?
They're both working on the same bill. It's the Pentagon budget. The House voted it through, the House Armed Services Committee voted it through with this amendment, and then the Senate Armed Services Committee voted it through with this amendment and an additional amendment preventing the military from building any biofuel refineries. So
preventing it.
Well, let me be precise. They can't build a biofuel refinery without explicit congressional authorization.
I see.
They can't just run off and make their own decisions. They need to come check with Congress before they do it.
And how does that differ from a normal check and balance in terms of their Pentagon spending?
Typically, you know, these things are always in flux through administrations and as social norms change and everything else. But traditionally, the military has largely been left to make these kind of strategic decisions on its own. It's given a budget and it has to justify the budget to Congress, but typically Congress has refrained from micromanaging. But you know, that changes. Some Congresses assert themselves more than others along political grounds, but this is a pretty nakedly political bid to insert themselves in the military's decisions.
So it's if the Pentagon wanted to produce its own fuel, it's almost like having to get an F-35 fighter jet clearance, which is a multi-trillion dollar type thing. So this is baldly political.
Ironically, at the very same time this is going on, the members of Congress on those same committees are practically forcing the military to accept this F-35 program that it doesn't want, to build planes that the military says it doesn't need.
But those are jobs in every congressman's constituency, so that's why they're all fighting over those pieces of pie, right?
It just goes to show that, as is true almost everywhere in U.S. federal politics, fiscal conservatism is a complete fig leaf. It's a complete distraction. That's the brand they're putting on front of it. But clearly, they don't care. Clearly, fiscal conservatism is limited, right? They're forcing the military to buy these expensive planes, and even more ironically, they're trying to push the military to use more expensive fossil fuels, coal to liquid fuels.
That was Hitler's favorite.
Yes, the military has said we don't want that, and actually we're prohibited by the 2007 Energy Act from buying fuels that are dirtier than fossil fuels. So we can't do that, and we don't want to do that. And Congress is trying to now nullify that provision of the 2007 Energy Act and force the military to pay more for a dirtier fossil fuel. So again,
how do you define dirtier in that sense? Like, how are they defining it?
More CO2. I mean, it dirtier based on CO2.
Not in terms of extraction or refinement.
Right. No. Just in terms of carbon content. So, you know, the notion that cost or money is driving this is silly. It's an expression of the Republicans on the committee supporting fossil fuels and opposing clean energy. I mean, that's the theme that ties all their various disparate actions together.
What are some of the political talking points that they're using that are beyond just cost cutting? Like, how can they somehow come up with a upside down explanation to voters about this?
Well, the argument they make to other members of Congress and to the sort of elite, the U.S. political elite, is all about cost cutting, at least in this limited context. The argument they're going to make to their base, or to the more, you know, sort of popular argument, is this is the military, this is Obama forcing the military to indulge his sort of his dreamy notions of clean energy and, you know, the green agenda has no place in the military, and the military should just be focused on military stuff. And this is just sort of social engineering by Obama that they're trying to prevent. So the Republicans want to make it look like Obama has imposed this on the military rather than the truth, which is that the military has come to these conclusions on its own and has and came to them before Obama was on the scene.
And that's the reality. So were these Republicans opposing this when the military was doing this under the George W. Bush administration?
Well, the sort of in military circles, they date it back to 2003. There was this Marine commander on the initial rush to Baghdad. You remember in the first Iraq war, there was this huge, massive rush to Baghdad towards the very beginning of the war. And this Marine commander was going so fast that he was outrunning his oil convoys, his fuel convoys, and he kept having to stop and wait for them to catch up. And so he wrote this memo to the military leadership saying you need to release us from the tether of fuel, is what he called it. He said these oil convoys, these fuel convoys, are serving as a tether, making us heavy, making us slow, limiting our range of movement. And this was in 2003. So it's been getting, you know, as the Iraq and Afghanistan wars have ground on, you know, all these fuel logistics of distributing fuel are taking place in the theater of war. So there's these convoys crisscrossing, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan, and they get shot at and they get blown up, and there, you know, there's, you know, it's one of the main sources of casualties in both those wars is or fuel convoys. So they're vulnerable in terms of lives, and they're extremely expensive, and tactically they limit your fighting effectiveness. So the military accepted all of that before Obama was around. I mean, this has been brewing for a long time.
And any senior military official has studied the Pacific War, World War II, and the Pacific Theater, where that tether of fuel was one of the keys to the Japanese defeat and the Nazis as well in Russia.
Right. The notion that supply lines, particularly fuel supply lines, are a vulnerability is not new. What's new, I think, in the U.S. context is two things. One, the military has become extremely energy intensive. Part of that is they have bigger, stronger vehicles that use more fuel. They just have more vehicles. They have more radios and computers and that kind of equipment. So they just need much more oil now. And like I said, in Iraq and Afghanistan, all that logistics around oil. In the first Gulf War, we just drove fuel in from Kuwait, so it was easier and didn't produce the same vulnerability. But in Iraq and Afghanistan, all this stuff is happening in the theater of war. So this is what's made it more salient recently.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with David Roberts. He's a staff writer at grist.org. David, you also wrote a great piece, a longer piece on this subject, last November in Outside Magazine called The Marines Go Renewable. And I'll try to link to that on seachangeradio.com. And you mentioned how some in Congress had been using the Solyndra solar debacle as a reason not to go green. Why don't you expand a little bit on the Solyndra crutch, if you will?
Sure. Well, you know, insofar as clean energy has come to be seen as a Democratic issue, Republicans oppose it. That's just sort of the nature of the Republican Party these days, is to oppose whatever Democrats are for. And they needed, but the problem is, politically, the problem is that clean energy, and this is notably different than climate change. The subject of climate change is highly polarizing, but clean energy is almost universally popular across demographics, across parties, across regions. Poll after poll after poll shows that Americans support moving to clean energy. They support spending extra money on it. They support America developing those industries, those clean energy industries. So it's just an incredibly popular topic, a bipartisan popularity. So Republicans needed some wedge. They needed some talking point or some wedge to get into that and start to peel off Republicans from that consensus around clean energy. And so, when Solyndra came along, it just turned out to be a gift to them, a perfect talking point, because it plays on government favoritism and government handouts and government picking winners and all these themes where Republicans are confident, and Republicans are confident in their rhetoric and winning those arguments.
And it's very anecdotal as well.
Well, it is the nature of political talking points to strip things out of context.
Exactly.
That's a feature, not a bug. So, yeah, I mean, they're trying, what they've been trying to do in a really concerted way for a couple of years now is make clean energy synonymous with Solyndra in the public's mind. That's why they keep investigating the hell out of it, even though, well over a year into this thing, they've yet to uncover any wrongdoing whatsoever, but they're not going to stop investigating it because they want to keep it in the, they want to keep it in the headlines. And so if clean energy becomes associated with the military, which is one of the few institutions left that Americans really trust, this will be disastrous for fossil fuel interests, just in terms of culture, in terms of image and appearance. So there's a real war on to define all clean energy as Solyndra and to dismiss the military's efforts as another version of this picking winners and spending money profligately on silly liberal preoccupations and all that kind of stuff. So they have to be careful about it, though, because they don't ever want to diss the military directly. So what they're trying to do is say this is just Obama's political appointees imposing this Solyndra-style winner-picking, money-spending profligacy onto the military. And it's not accurate, but it is an effective talking point. And Democrats, this is a microcosm of a problem Democrats have on so many issues, but the Democratic coalition is so big that it includes a lot of Democrats who live in dirty energy states and who are very tied to oil and coal. So whereas the Republicans are unified against clean energy and for fossil fuels almost entirely, with some exceptions, the Democrats are divided. So there's no concerted pushback. There's very little, it seems to me, effort to use this, what the military is doing, as a kind of rhetorical device to define clean energy for the public. It's just not being done.
And Solyndra was trying to compete in a space, and they ended up losing out, but they were trying to compete in a space that the U.S. military actually has adopted in this thin solar technology. You write about how each Marine would carry 20 to 35 pounds of batteries with them in Afghanistan, and now they're using thin solar as a solution, these solar portable alternative communications energy systems known as spaces. This is just the tip of the iceberg. Why don't you talk about some of the innovations that the military has been experimenting with beyond the low-hanging fruit, like alternative fuels?
Sure. You have to remember that there's actually several different things going on in the military that all kind of fall under this rubric of greening. One is, the one that's most politically controversial right now, is substituting biofuels for oil in the big ships and planes and tanks. That's one thing. Another thing is taking military bases and trying to generate energy on site there so that they can become more independent of civilian energy grids, which are, especially in the U.S., which are old and vulnerable and break down a lot. And since, remember, so much warfare now is done in small buildings on military bases, piloting these drones, having consistent, reliable electricity supply to military bases is a serious strategic thing. But the third, and the one I wrote about in my piece, is efforts to use less oil on the battlefield. And this is a purely tactical play. It's just a matter of making Marines and other and the rest of the services more battle effective. So the Marines around 2009 got religion on this. Finally said, okay, you know, this reliance on massive amounts of oil is crippling us on the battlefield, and we've got to do something about it. So they put this guy, Colonel Charette, in charge of a new energy team, and he just immediately set up what's called an experimental forward operating base on a base in California, sort of like a fake Afghanistan forward operating base. And they started bringing in clean energy technology innovators to sort of test their products in this realistic environment to see what would work in the field. And, you know, they did rounds of testing, and then a couple of those technologies proved out and got deployed to the front lines in Helmand province in Afghanistan. And the ones that worked well there are now being deployed to all Marines in Afghanistan. So the Marines have really moved ahead incredibly quickly and effectively on this. And some of the things they're using are the one you mentioned, which is these roll-up solar panels, which a single person can pack. And those replace batteries for if you're out on missions in the field. Then they also have these sort of fold-out solar panels that look like sort of trailers that they drag behind a truck. They fold out into four solar panels. And those, a couple of those can power a small forward operating base, just the computers and the air conditioning if they need it. They're also trying to use less energy, so they're insulating their tents better. This is a huge, you know, it sounds simple, but it's a huge thing. There's been a lot of money spent air conditioning the desert over there in Iraq and Afghanistan, and just creating tents that keep the cool air from the air conditioning inside the tent alone is a huge thing. There's also solar panels that can be draped over tents. They're experimenting with hybrid engines on their vehicles that can generate electrical power when they're parked, and on and on. I think they're on the third now round of this forward operating base, this experimental forward operating base. I think they're on the third round, and now they're starting to experiment with on-site water purification, so they don't have to ship water to the front lines, and on and on. And this is this is what struck me as I reported the piece about the Marines, is it's all inside the Marines completely apolitical. There's no element of politics in this. They don't care about climate change or the fight about climate change. They don't care about Solyndra. They don't care about the sort of cultural valence of clean energy in the U.S. They want to prevent Marines being killed in fuel convoys. That is their sole focus. And sort of as a consequence of this, they're moving really quickly, and they're just ruthlessly sort of pragmatic about it. It was really, honestly, as someone who reports quite a bit about politics, it was an incredibly refreshing experience to talk to people who are purely pragmatic about it.
Fighting soldiers from the sky, fearless men who jump and die, men who mean just what they say, the brave men of the Green Beret. Silver wings upon their chest, these are men, America's best. 100 men will test today, but only 3 win the Green Beret.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/seachangeradio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with David Roberts. He's a staff writer at grist.org. You mentioned this Colonel Charette, who heads the energy team within the Marines. Since the political infighting, or at least the hay that's being made politically, has been about cutting costs, what kind of cost-benefit analysis has Colonel Charette and his team presented to Congress in terms of the real costs and savings that would be involved in some of these green initiatives?
Right. Well, you have to pick a couple of things apart. One is, right now, Congress, or at least Republicans in Congress, are going after the biofuels program mainly because that's where the big money is and the big amounts of energy.
Is that smart politics? I mean, when you have even like George W. Bush saying we're going to make fuel out of switchgrass and algae and all these other things. I mean, he's even embraced that. How can that be good politics?
Well, it may be stupid, but it would be less stupid than going after something like what Charette's doing, which is directly involved in saving lives. So nobody's going to touch that, right? So as far as I know, he's operated free from political pressure so far. And one of the great things about the Marine, kind of the Marines' ethos is they don't pause every 5 minutes and fill out a bunch of forms and do another cost benefit analysis and like submit spreadsheets. They're just barreling forward on this, and they're going based on success in the field. They put the stuff in Marines' hands in the field. They get reports back from the Marines, and what works gets deployed. It's, you know, so there's a lot of work being done in the background by think tanks and et cetera about the true costs of military fuel and what's called the fully burdened cost of fuel. Because, you know, most of what is used in the field in Iraq and Afghanistan is this really high-grade jet fuel. They think it's cost ineffective to import multiple kinds of fuel. So everything, even that little diesel generator that's air conditioning a tent in Afghanistan, is running on high-grade jet fuel.
Really? Yeah. And what kind of cost is that per gallon? It's not $4.35 like we have here in San Francisco, I'm imagining.
Surprisingly, it is in the $3 to $4 to $5 range per gallon at the pump, because they buy so much of it in the sheer scale. But once you factor in the costs of transporting it, you know, over the Hindu Kush or you know, across this hostile territory in Iraq and Afghanistan to the big bases, and then getting it out to those forward operating bases, the little bases out on the front lines, they have to do it by helicopter because there's not even safe roads to get it to them. So they carry this jet fuel to the forward operating bases in gigantic bladders hanging off of helicopters. So by the time that gallon of fuel reaches the front lines, the fully burdened cost can be up to $400 a gallon. Once you factor in the cost of transporting it, the cost of lives, protecting it, the, you know, the helicopter, the danger, everything else. Point being, those soldiers and Marines on the front lines in Afghanistan are using some of the most expensive fuel on the planet once all the costs are factored in, and they're doing it extremely inefficiently right now. So making them more efficient and helping them generate more of their own power and helping them just use less energy and waste less energy is such a no-brainer that at least thus far it has been off the political radar. I think Republicans would have to be really, I think that might finally be overreach too far, even for these Republicans.
David Roberts, staff writer at grist.org, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks a lot, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Paul Simon, The Clash, and Sergeant Barry Sadler. Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Farm Fresh to You Organic Produce Delivery Service, connecting people to farms and leading the progressive change in America's food system. To learn more, go to farmfreshtoyou.com. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.